Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 4th of August. A delight to have you with us. Hopefully the weekend, if you got to experience and enjoy a weekend, it was a lovely palate cleanser. Get you ready for this week at large and the first full week of this month of August. And we welcome you all. Beautiful weather. Oh, my goodness. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful weather. And just perfect. There could not be a more perfect summer weekend, I don't think. Anybody do anything fun? Anybody do anything they want to?
Oh, we saw the Comedy of Errors at Hudson Valley Shakespeare in Garrison.
Oh, that's a beautiful place.
Yeah. It was a beautiful place, a beautiful evening, and it was a very enjoyable performance.
Yeah, that's great. You and George and...
George and my and my
yeah,
wife.
Yeah, yep. That's great. Oh, that's lovely. Very, very nice. I saw Bob Dylan.
Oh,
I saw the Outlaw tour. Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson, and Wilco, who provides our theme music. Just a reminder.
Right.
And it was cool. It was really cool to see. It was neat.
Good.
But Dylan has this move, and I didn't know this, and probably people listening to me right now who are Dylan aficionados know this, but I didn't know this. So Dylan has this cool move where, you know, if you go to SPAC and you see a show, they have the cameras on. And then if you're in the back of the lawn, the camera's there and it puts a close-up of the picture. Well, Dylan doesn't allow that. So apparently in New Jersey the night before, he just demanded that the camera be off. And I guess there was such a hullabaloo that the next night at SPAC, they just had this wide shot of the stage bathed in red, and there's just like this little white blob that was his hat behind the piano, and that's all you could see. Now I was lucky enough; I was up front. But if you were back, like 10 rows, not to mention the lawn.
You just saw Bob Dylan's hat. Maybe.
You saw a red glow and a little white blob. I will say, however, whatever was coming out of that little white blob was amazing and phenomenal, and he sounded great. And it was a really fun, very nostalgic evening. It was a nice night at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center. All right, let's get to business. We have a lot to talk about. And, yeah, that's sort of how I felt about it. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of things going on, and we will get right to it. Let me introduce the group to you. Political consultant Libby Post is here. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well.
Oh,
thank
good.
You.
I'm glad you had a good time at the concert.
Yeah, very, very good. I like concerts. These are my kind of concerts because I go to a lot of concerts, and a lot of times I have to stand up, and my knees and my hips don't like that.
Right.
But this was a very mellow sit down.
Yeah.
Watch the show.
No one's
going to
get in the front row. And
no.
Yeah.
No. There were a lot of there were people there who were very well equipped with wheelchairs and canes and so forth. And I felt, well, if I need one, there's one right there.
Some of them on stage.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. It was. Yeah. Willie has a cool move too, because Willie comes out and they put him in a chair. And then, but there's the drape is down, and then as they start playing, it rises, and there he is, and it just looks like a king on the throne. It's great.
That's appropriate.
Very, very
yeah.
cool. Very neat. And then he doesn't move around after that, but it was very cool. So Libby is here. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
We welcome our friend Jim Ketterer to the program, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Happy to be here. Happy Monday.
Good to have you with us. I feel like we've won the lottery. Mark was here on Friday, and then we talked about all kinds of stuff. And now we know more stuff about the stuff,
mm-hmm.
and we still have Mark to talk about the stuff. So
that's a great thing.
That's
isn't
a great,
it?
Great thing. And Mark Whitman, of course, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Joe. I too had a great weekend and happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Thank you very much. So We were talking about the jobs report. Aaron Pasitti and Mark Whitman got into a vibrant conversation about tariffs and about the markets and about the jobs and inflation and so forth. And it was great. It was a great conversation. And so then Teresa was here, of course, as well. And we had a great talk about all that. But what we didn't know is that if you get bad news from someone, the way you handle that is you just fire them. That's
well, that's his signature. You're fired.
So the person responsible, the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, was fired on Friday because the jobs report was not a good jobs report. And the president says that this was data that was
rigged.
They were meddling in this, and it is was not a good deal here. But what we do know is the Bureau of Labor Statistics is officially part of the Labor Department, whose secretary is a member of the president's cabinet. But the agency operates independently, producing detailed nonpartisan data on employment, prices, wages, and other topics. Ha, you say. Good data helps not just the Fed, it helps the government, but it also helps the private sector, Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, said. The United States has been a leader in that for over 100 years, and we really need to continue that, in my view. So then this information comes out. It's not to the president's liking, and the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics is pushed out. Erica McEntifer, is that correct? Tarfer? Entifer, I believe.
I think Entifer, yeah.
Okay.
I think.
Is the person who was pushed out as a result of this. A lot of waves and dominoes as a result of this, and a lot of economists who are looking and saying, what did you just do? So we'll start with that and talk about the firing of America's economic data collector. How big a deal is this, Mark Whitman?
That's a great question, Joe. In a way, this is just part of a piece, though, isn't it? We knew Donald Trump did this. I mean, he fibbed about the small things, right? His weight and height were akin to that of Lennox Lewis at the time of Lennox Lewis being a championship boxer in the world. The track of storms used to be changed by a Sharpie. It'd be terrible if we had a president who mistold the truth about, let's say, a pandemic in this country or the effectiveness of a vaccine and led to the deaths of people who listened to him more so than those that didn't. It'd also be horrible. I mean, imagine if this guy ever he called the economic statistics rigged. Imagine if this guy was involved in an election and he didn't win and he called it rigged. And his followers believed him, and they took violent measures against his opponents. I mean, that would be horrible. Imagine if he lied about climate change, right? So I don't know why. Yeah, I laughed sadly when this happened, but this is who Donald Trump has been, and it is who he will continue to be. And yes, the 2020 election was rigged. 2 + 2 = 5, and that's the state's most powerful weapon, is when they can get you not to believe your eyes and ears were in a very different set of circumstances. So I was entertained by how aghast people were at this because, I could see it coming. I mean, I'm a little surprised.
No, I agree with you. I don't know that I was aghast, but it just seemed to fall into line with what we would have expected. However, my first question was and remains, which is, does that mean that we no longer get accurate data that is released as a monthly jobs report?
I think this is a lot like what Trump's doing to the economy. you can take a few bolts. If you're on a long trip on your airplane making a number of stops, and you see the pilot selling bolts at stops and saying, well, it worked last time, and you get to altitude on the next leg of the journey, and everything's fine, and he sells more bolts at the next stop and says, don't worry. That's kind of what he's done with a number of institutions in this country. But unfortunately, he is consuming a lot of this country's strengths. So the technical answer is there's no reason to believe that the person taking this job on will fudge the numbers or the numbers will be any less reliable in the short run. And we'll continue on to the next destination, and the pilot will sell a few parts of the plane, and we'll see how it goes from there. But I would argue that the practice is demonstrably negative, and you can see that in the deaths that happened during the pandemic and the consequences in the election and what's likely to happen to our economy given Donald Trump's economic policy. So that's my answer. In the short run, we're okay if you want to look at this in isolation, but I don't know if you'd look at this more broadly if we really are okay.
3 to 4 days, the president says he'll name a new head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And this is yet another example of somebody that nobody probably even knew who it was until they got fired. But they were there and they were doing their job and everything was fine. The point I would like to start off with you, Jim, which is I don't know if this needs to be said, but I feel that it needs to be said, which is according to all eyes on this currently, the numbers were accurate. Mm-hmm. There was no questioning of prior, other than the president didn't like it. There wasn't any other concern outside of the president's group that said that these numbers were questionable.
Yeah, I mean, there are always people who question the whole revision of numbers with these particular statistics. People who aren't really, you know, focused on how they're produced and the people who are producing them, but they say the mere fact that they've been revised somehow factors into a broader conspiracy theory that something is amiss. So this isn't the first time that the revision of numbers has set people off. I've lived in countries where the statistics are purposefully skewed, and it's the ones that get noticed are the economic statistics. Nobody believes them. It also has a chilling effect on foreign direct investment, on people having any kind of trust in the overall system, so it kind of scares money away. And I think, you know, I see this move as part of a broader view of the president and the people around him and the people who support him about how they think about government personnel as well. And, you know, having worked for the government myself, you know, we've entered fully into this era that the great Tom Nichols book talks about, the death of expertise. And there's no real valuing of specific expertise that has been built up by people, you know, being trained in the right way and having the right experience. And we've entered fully into the era of the loyalty test. And this undoes something that has been at the heart of the success of American institutions since 1883 and the signing of the Pendleton Act, which created a merit-based system in the government. Now, some positions like this one, the person who was fired, have to have a presidential appointment and a Senate confirmation, but that doesn't mean that they're not merit-based. By the way, I would just say as a side note, the Pendleton Act was signed by President Chester Alan Arthur, who was buried very close to here in Albany Rural Cemetery.
Yeah.
And that has been something that has made the American institutions work in a way that many other governments around the world have not been able to replicate. So to undo that is highly problematic. And this is just one case. There's another case that has happened in the past few days that hasn't gotten the attention that I think it deserves, but I'll bring it up now. And that's Jen Easterly,
who has had a very distinguished career, a graduate of West Point, a Rhodes Scholar, throughout an Afghanistan combat veteran, worked for National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, not a wild-eyed liberal, and then most recently was appointed to a position during the Biden administration, but appointed to a technical position heading cybersecurity. She was recently appointed to a teaching position at West Point. And this is the kind of person, having just read her background, who we would like to have our future leaders studying with. The day after she was appointed, she, or a couple days, was fired because Laura Loomer had somehow found out about this and said, this is an outrage, she's somehow a Biden plant, and they fired her. No real valuing of all that expertise and experience that I just mentioned, but just to say she has some hint of Biden, she must be disloyal, get rid of her. And this is just going to have all kinds of negative implications as we multiply this across our institutions.
We're up against a break, and I want to hear from Libby on the other side of it. What you just said, though, is brings up so many different questions, but what power does this Lisa Loomer have? I mean, this has been amazing to listen to over the last several weeks and months. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll do more with Libby right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, Mark Whitman, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post, all here. We are talking about the fact that the jobs report came out on Friday. Those numbers were not to the president's liking, so he fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The questions that we are bringing up are, what do we do moving forward, and what does this mean, and what are the takeaways from that particular action? We now go to Libby Post. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you think of this?
This is all out of the authoritarian playbook, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't like the numbers, so I'm going to fire you. You know, that's happened lots in the past with dictators and banana republics and all kinds of places. And where this is what happens when we let a fascist in the White House. I'm sorry if that offends anybody, but that's exactly what we have. We have an authoritarian who looks up to other authoritarians and has no idea of what democracy really means. He has no idea what, let's say, intelligent conversation means, or using facts and history and not wanting to repeat history. He doesn't know any of that because he doesn't care. All he cares about is his own personal power, his political power now, and molding this country and this government to his whims. And while I don't think it will last forever, we are now living through what Germany was living through in the 30s.
I asked Mark Whitman this question and about, you know, can we trust the next jobs report, no matter who, you know, who is overseeing those numbers. The president has said that somebody will be named within the week. My other thing, and which the president has said is, I believe this is a quote or pretty close to it, which was, I want to get one of my own people in there.
So that his own people can lie to the American public about what the jobs numbers are, so the economy looks better for him, but really doesn't look better for the average person?
Okay, so that, and then okay, so there
okay.
we are. So let's
That's let, where let, we are.
So let's put a bookmark in that for a second. Mm-hmm. Now back to Mark Whitman. Mark, if you are lying about the state of the economy, if you're lying about, let's say you are, I don't know that we are, but let's say we are, about the jobs numbers or whatever the case is, that obviously has to play. There is the reality. Whether you're reporting on the reality or not, there's still the reality. And as that plays itself out, when does that then catch up?
Well, as soon as people fear that there's a difference between what's being reported and what's actually happened, investors, and by the way, investors do this with respect to debt or equity of private corporations, they start to discount the rate at which they lend to or invest in, but in the United States government, they'll start to discount the rate at which they lend to the U.S. government to adjust for the fact that they're taking on more risk if you're being opaque about what actual economic
discount
statistics
are. Discount or increase interest
rates?
What,
yeah, sorry, Libby, thank you very much. The simplest way to state it is that they will demand a higher interest rate from the U.S. government
That's
to compensate
right.
for the additional risk that they're taking because the United States isn't being as clear as it once was about the economic data behind the economy. And that's the it's a simple calculation. And again, that's why I made the reference of selling bolts. You can't get away with it for very long, and it will have a cost for all of us, as will Trump's tariffs and many of the other economic policies that he's enacted. So the real interesting thing here is that that organization is incredibly well respected, incredibly professional, very transparent. You cannot see results from the survey that are linked to survey respondents, but you can eventually the public has incredible access to the data and the methodology behind the information that the Department of Labor puts out. So much so that the number of people who can truly audit it and review it is a very small set, because you have to have you need to know a lot about statistics. And so it's incredibly transparent. And if that begins to if the United States is less transparent, it will cost us literally.
And can I just add too that when you start messing with the economic data, it doesn't end with economics. What I have seen in other places with my own eyes is also the skewing of census data. And now this matters a lot for the drawing of our congressional districts, for the sending of money to states, also other demographic data, health data. All of this starts to get altered by governments for political reasons. But once you open that door, it is really very, very dangerous. And it's almost impossible to put it back together again without a lot of upheaval.
And what people don't seem to connect the dots to is that the destruction of media, of news media in this country, which he is hell-bent on doing, right? We saw CBS, Paramount, whatever, Sky, whatever it's now called, bend at the knee. We've seen other media companies bend at the knee on a local level, because I did this work when I was lobbying on the Local Journalism Sustainability Act. On a local level, if there's nobody, no local journalism watching what's going on at town hall meetings and all town board meetings and local meetings, that kind of stuff, borrowing rates for those municipalities go up because the banks can't see, because there's no good journalism or no effective journalism. And so the borrowing rates go up for our local municipalities. All we need to do is connect these dots. What he's doing to national journalism and undermining its credibility, again, what Mark said, those interest rates will go up. Now, we have to wonder, who in the Republican Party or who in his merry little band will benefit from those interest rates going up, because they sit on the bank's boards or they sit somewhere where they get, or their stocks or whatever. So you have to wonder how this is going to help his cronies, because that's all this is about, is helping him and his family and his cronies. Emoluments Act be damned.
I think it's more political.
I think it's all political.
But I think the benefit that he thinks is going to accrue to him by potentially lying about economic statistics. But, you know, to Jim's point, once you open the door, Jim, the door's already open and Trump's walking through it. Mm-hmm. Look what he's done with law firms, with academic
right.
institutions. Oh, yeah. And look what he did with the results of the last, the second to last election when he lost, and the dispersions that he and others cast about the results. I worry, Joe, just to broaden this out a little bit, on Friday it was also announced that one of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve is leaving. Her departure was expected. That will mean when Trump appoints her replacement that three of the seven will then have been appointed by Trump, and the remaining four will be a Biden or Obama appointees. And I'm going to start wearing a T-shirt. I'm going to take my Ruth Bader Ginsburg organ donor T-shirt. I'm going to cross out Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I'm going to put Jerome Powell, because it's critical that Jerome Powell stay on the Federal Reserve. He can no longer be chair, but still stay on the Board of Governors. If he doesn't, having four Trump appointees to the Board of Governors could be extraordinarily deleterious to the United States, not only in terms of interest rate and monetary policy, but also in terms of our willingness in a crisis to extend what are called swap lines, which is a fancy mm-hmm. way of saying we have historically and to our benefit extended credit to other countries during times of financial crisis, like the financial meltdown in 08-09. And if the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve starts to take a different disposition towards those things, the cost could mount quickly for the United States and for the globe.
It's interesting that Powell is a Trump appointee, but Trump 1.0. And I think his behavior and his professionalism highlights the difference between that first administration and people who came from outside the inner circle of Donald Trump. And Trump 2.0, where the loyalty test, as I said before, really rules the day.
Even though the president continues to say that it was Biden who mm-hmm. plays
well, there's that
into
too.
That.
Well,
yeah.
You know, he. This is right out of Goebbels' playbook, folks. This is like just keep repeating the lie, repeat the lie, repeat the lie, and then everybody will start to believe it because they're not hearing anything else. That's why our voices, the voices of Democrats, the voices of people who are concerned with the future. You know, some of us, I think, think, oh, well, okay, we'll get through this, and then we'll get a Democrat, and everything will go back to the way it was. Well, I'm not so sure that we're going to be able to elect a Congress who's going to be willing to reverse these tax cuts that just passed to benefit the rich and hurt the poor. Because then it puts them in the firing line of, well, you're raising taxes on all of us, because that's how it will be messaged. So this is we're at a turning point, and this country either needs to understand what this man is doing and say no in lots of different ways, especially next year, or we are opening the door to not only financial ruin but political ruin. And we will no longer, not that I think we are seen right now as a world leader, but we guaranteed not to be seen as a world leader. And we will tank the world's economy.
June writes to us and says, anyone want to bet that Trump will appoint himself as the head of labor statistics? That's a lot of jobs. That's a busy business card.
But do you think he could do the math?
What?
Who's his emissary to everyone? Steve Witkoff?
Yeah.
I think he's going to appoint him or Marco Rubio.
Rubio's got four jobs.
I just want to clarify on the Powell thing that it was Donald Trump who in 2018 appointed Powell chair of the Federal Reserve Board. And then Biden reappointed him for a second four-year term as chair, not to the board itself, but as chair. His term runs through 2000. His meaning Powell's term runs through 2018. It's historically the case that most chairs stepped off the board, but it's not always the case. I think Greenspan remained on after he was no longer mm-hmm. Chair. Maybe to have a first row seat to watch all the carnage that he created. I don't know.
His term is still 28?
2018. Oh, or, yeah. Sorry, 2028. Thank
2028.
You. Thank
okay,
you for
so,
clarifying.
Yeah.
2028. So the point being, and it's the. Despite the fact that the people think it's the Open Market Committee, it's actually technically the Board of Governors, the seven in the Board of Governors that are sort of the seat of power. And it is unusual for the other Board of Governor members to vote against the chairman. I think it's unprecedented for them to, as a body, force the chairman into a minority, sort of straight out outvote him. But I have every comfort that if Donald Trump asks his appointees to do unreasonable things, that those, you know, bankers are not typically wilting lilies. I think they'll stand in his way.
If you want a little behind the scenes of what goes on at the show while it's going on, as Mark was talking, I quickly had to Google, is Alan Greenspan still alive?
Yeah.
Yes.
And he is.
The maestro.
99 years old. Good for him. All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. I want to talk about tariffs and how they figure into all of this. And we'll get to that discussion right after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. The music presented is that of Wes Montgomery. A reminder that we have a playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable, and you can check out the tracks and look at the playlist that we play going into our panel segments. wamc.org/roundtable. Okay, so let's further this conversation just a smidge, and that is to talk about tariffs and what, again, Mark, we saw, I believe we were reacting on Friday to the deadline and what we knew about the tariffs and what had happened and how that figured into this big economic soup. And so Friday played out. Where are we on Monday morning?
Well, I think we've got five deals in the bag and we've got 85 still to go is the answer here. Look, I heard a interview show, I think it was Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN, and Zandi Mittenbeddows, who's the editor of The Economist, said it really well. We're not in the catastrophic case that Trump proposed when he talked about Liberation Day. We are in a tariff environment that we haven't seen for decades. And we're headed, if you assume things sort of settle out and you use the deal with the EU as a template, which I think the administration will, we're going to settle out in a tariff regime that's painful. But it is ultimately, Trump thinks he's winning, but ultimately this will be deleterious to the United States. Consumers will face less choices. They'll pay higher prices. The industry will focus more on lobbying government. Once these get in place, they're going to be hard to remove because you're going to have, and it's proven the case historically, that you're going to have domestic producers who are going to lobby the government to continue to be protected. And so in aggregate, you know, the United States is going to lose. It will not be as catastrophic. I would like to say one thing, just to clarify with the listeners. When people like AOC say that the consumer is going to pay all of it, it being the tariff, I'm a little surprised because she was, an economics major at BU. She needs to check the trade textbook that they probably assigned to her. How much the consumer pays versus how much the producer pays is based on basically how much power they have. And economics have a fancy term called cross price elasticity in the case of the consumer, or production elasticity in the case of the producer. But there are cases when the producer will pay some or even most of a tariff. But in most cases, you can assume that the consumer is going to pay a good share of it. And sometimes the Republicans, in their leisure domain around arguments, hide behind imprecise arguments around who's going to pay. But the answer does distill back to the answer of you're going to limit U.S. choices. You're going to increase costs for the United States. That's why Trump thinks he's going to raise, you know, trillions of dollars over 10 years from these tariffs. And the fact that you are going to raise money and you are going to protect domestic producers is going to make it hard to reverse these things and make the politics of tariffs become detrimental to the United States and to the globe. So I wanted to, and that's where all this is going to settle out. And Joe, like the labor report, if you watch the labor report month to month as a civilian and get all tied up in it, you're doing the wrong thing. You need to sort of take a couple steps back and take a holistic sort of bird's eye view of this. And that's where I think we're ending up on tariffs. And I think, you know, 99% of the economists who look at this would agree with what Zanny Minton-Beddoes has said over the weekend about how this hurts the United States.
But, you know, you were talking about AOC and being an econ major and not understanding, you know, who pays what on tariffs. Donald Trump purports to have gone to the Wharton School and is always touting his expertise in that area. And yet he didn't take or certainly did not absorb key elements of, you know, the most basic economics course about what a tariff is and what it does. And also how international trade actually works. And so this makes me think, you know, when we talk about these deals, what I think is getting lost by all kinds of media about these deals is the starting point, which is, what is the problem that is supposedly getting solved by these deals? I mean, we talked before about the EU deal, and people were kind of breathing a sigh of relief because where the tariff level ended up was going to be much more optimistic and lower than where Trump had proposed, but much, much, much higher than what existed just a year ago. And so what is supposedly being solved is actually something, is a good situation that is being ruined
right
by these deals. So that's one thing. Secondly, you know, they're on the actual operation of tariffs. There's tariffs and there's effective tariffs. And so a lot of things that have components, which is really how current day international trade is working, there's a lot of components of things that are going to be sold as American goods but have international components that are tariffed. Those prices are going to go up. Also, for industries that are American and are protected, so outside goods that are coming in that industry have a tariff price, those American prices tend to go up because they can. And those producers can now garner more money for their goods. They might not go right up to the tariff level, but they will approach it. And so even American goods, people are saying, well, you should just buy American. Those prices are also going to go up. When I was on last week, Terry Gibson was on with us, and he said, this is back to like being very clear and basic about what a tariff is. It ought to be said every single time that it's mentioned that this is a tax on the American consumer. Mm-hmm. And it is a tax in one way or another. And so it depends on how much, as you said, Mark, the devil's in the details of how much the tax is going to be. But it's not a reduction. It is an increase in what people will pay in one way or another.
Mark either disagrees or he's looking for a train coming.
No, I just, I guess what I agree directionally. We don't have any argument. It's dangerous to say that it's always a tax on the American consumer in terms of what they pay for a product. That's a little, it's almost always, I would say. I also think the tax in terms of our geopolitical positioning and in terms of the flexibility of supply chains around the world is pretty significant, and we're going to lose that too. But again, it's, you know, one on any one given product, who pays how much is there's a couple of big factors, as I talked about, and a myriad of others that affect the ultimate result. But I think you need to just say in aggregate, the United States consumer, the United States economy, and the United States politically will lose because of these tariffs. That's the.
But could you give me an example of when the American consumer will pay less?
No, there's no reason to believe there's no reason to believe that you would pay less, but I would be.
Or would benefit in any way.
I doubt that there's any of those, but I'm not going to go as far
maybe
as saying.
Maybe just for national security reasons,
but
I would say. Yeah.
But I'm not going to go as far as saying there's no case in which you wouldn't pay it. As a matter of fact, some of the peculiarities of what Trump is considering doing with drug prices gets into pretty esoteric marginal versus fixed.
But in
cost
almost
arguments.
All those cases, if it's a protected industry, those American prices will rise at least a bit, too.
Yeah,
toward
well,
the
that's,
tariff
that's
level.
A good, but actually, that, Jim, is a very good point, which is if you think about a good that's produced overseas, imported into the United States, and the cost of which goes up because of tariffs, if the substitutes in the United States are pretty direct substitutes, even indirect substitutes, those producers will have the ability to take the price up, even though there's no, they're not paying any tariff. As a matter of fact, I would argue if you put a high enough tariff on, say, bananas, which we even can't produce in the United States, that the cost of pitted fruit in the winter in the United States will increase, right? Because people see those, they go to the fruit section of their grocery store, yeah, and they look at those as alternatives, even though you wouldn't immediately think that. So I think directionally, I have no problem. The problem becomes, and Trump's good at this, right? He makes these emotional, blunt arguments. And when people like AOC get lost in the technicals and they get the technicals wrong, it makes it hard to make the broader point. So I think we'd always need to be careful.
Good point. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, do I have, a minute?
You have a minute.
Okay, and then I can pick up on the other side.
Yeah, I'm just looking up what's considered a pitted fruit. Go ahead.
Okay. So
peaches,
you know, in
plums,
my
cherries. Go
in
ahead.
In my business, you have to keep things simple for people to understand. You guys are talking all day long, and you can talk about this, and no one's going to understand it unless they have an economics degree or are higher education at a certain level. This may not be a tax, T-A-X, but it is an attack on the consumer. It is an attack on our economy, and it is an attack on the middle class and the working poor and the poor in this country. And these people do not care. It's just that simple. Cruelty, chaos, confusion, those are the three C's of this administration, and that's what they're going to continue to do. And the cruelty part of it is so obvious, but his followers think, oh, but it's not going to happen to me. Just wait, folks, because it is. You're going to lose your health care. You're going to lose your Medicaid. You're going to lose, we might lose parts of Medicare and Social Security. We're going to lose because of these policies and what this means to the government, what this means to the American person and our country in general. I mean, it's just an attack. That's what this is.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, move on to other subjects and get into more little tiffs. We welcome you, panel at WAMC. No, I know everybody was fine. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to go look for legislators in Texas. We'll see you in a few minutes. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have a great group this morning. Let me introduce them to you. Mark Whitman is here, investment banker on Wall Street. Jim Ketterer, senior fellow of the Bard Center for Civic Engagement and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is with us as well. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Well, things are interesting in Texas once again. The Texas Democrats are fleeing the state in an effort to block the GOP's House map overhaul. Now, the Democrats in Texas have done this before, and it is, I think, Mark talked about reading the story about the Bureau of Labor Statistics head being fired and you know, feeling the pain of that, but also just chuckling. I just think it's funny that all of the Democrats get it, like, leave the state. They just evacuate like roaches, like we're gone. So this is a mechanism, I guess, mm-hmm. Fleeing the state to block a redistricting plan that was backed by President Donald Trump, aimed at preserving the GOP's slim House majority. Escalating tensions as the broader fight over congressional district lines unfolds throughout the country ahead of the 2026 midterms. Texas Democrats have twice deployed the same tactic to combat legislation in the 22 years since Republicans have controlled all of state government, but those efforts ultimately failed. This time, Democrats plan to stay away for 2 weeks to run out the clock in a special legislative session called by the governor, Greg Abbott, to draw a map that would give Republicans five more House seats. The Texas House can conduct business only when two-thirds of its 150 members are present. A successful boycott would require participation from at least 51 of the chamber's 62 Democrats. A total of 57 have joined in, according to State Rep. John Rosenthal. Members travel to Boston and New York, he said, with the largest group landing in Chicago. They're migrating. All plan to remain gone until the conclusion of the session that ends on August 19th. Our goal right now, Rosenthal said, is to kill the session. Abbott said Democrats were willfully abandoning their jobs and he would go to court to remove and replace them if they do not show up on Monday. In addition, Democrats could each face 500 daily fines from the legislature and political blowback. As part of the special session, lawmakers are considering legislation to respond to last month's deadly floods, and blocking action on that key issue is likely to be unpopular. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has threatened to arrest legislators who break quorum, but he won't have jurisdiction over them if they stay out of the state.
Is there a law on the books that he can prosecute that if you break quorum, really all of them together, come on. You know, what is he going to do? Put them all in jail? This is just another, this isn't redistricting. This is gerrymandering. Let's be honest here. This is about unfairly midterm trying to change the playing field so that they don't lose the House. It's really pretty disgusting. And, you know, Greg Abbott is just another one of Trump's, I don't know, errand boys is the best way to put it. Trump says he wants to redraw the line, so Greg Abbott tries to make it happen. The Democrats stand up for democracy, they leave, and they'll get arrested. This is what we're facing in Texas, and we may very well face this in other states. The governor, right now, Governor Hochul's standing with the Texas legislators, Democrats who came here. Pritzker's probably going to do the same thing in Chicago, in Illinois. I mean, I'm sure he will. You know, this is just, if there's no other way to stop stealing an election than to leave the state so the laws don't get changed, then that's what you have to do if you believe in democracy.
The Representative Todd Hunter, who is the sponsor of this legislation, said it's a good plan for Texas that would give his party more seats in Congress. The primary changes are focused on five districts for partisan purposes, he said in committee. The DNC chair, Ken Martin, applauded Texas Democrats' response, saying their action showed real leadership. Republicans thought they could just rig the maps and change the rules without the American people taking notice. They were dead wrong.
Well, I think there's a lot of layers to this. One is that, you know, the country is really structured in a way where federalism matters and the power of the states matters. And so to have the president from the federal government exert enormous political power on a state to carry out activities that are reserved for the states is just another piece of this kind of collection of more executive power. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, running roughshod over one of the kind of core elements of the structure of our government that has worked for a long time, and the 10th Amendment of the Constitution that gives the states great flexibility. It also opens to do this, you know, between the 10-year cycle, opens a Pandora's box. The governor of New York has talked about possibly mm-hmm. doing this in New York.
Newsom.
Senator Booker in New Jersey said New Jersey should now start doing this. And so where does that stop? In terms of gerrymandering, you know, as I've said before, both parties do it, and it's become much, much more technologically sophisticated over time. It's kind of like house by house, street by street that these lines are drawn. And as the country has become more politically polarized, and when it's much less likely for people to vote across party lines, the ability for the people who make their living drawing these district lines has become, you know, hyper-specific. And so if somebody says, okay, we want to carve out five more seats, they probably can do that. But what's the cost to in all the other ways that I just mentioned? And I think it's really toxic for the nature of our federal system.
They don't care. That's the issue. They don't care about what the long-term costs are going to be. They see it only as short-term and being able to control the political process right now so that we can get this agenda done, which not just includes the tariffs and all that stuff. It includes taking away the agency of for women, for LGBTQ folks, for people of color. You know, it's about taking away everyone's rights except if you're straight, white, and male. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. And it's not going to stop until women are consistently bleeding out in parking lots because they can't get an abortion, right? And this is already happened. Women have died. Children are dying of communicable diseases because somebody's got a brain that a worm ate, RFK Jr., and he's dismantling our public health structure. What people don't understand or haven't really looked at yet is the impact of these cuts, the big, beautiful, bombastic bill, on community health centers across the state, federally qualified health centers, which are the bulwark of providing care for those in underserved areas. And they're going to be, and that's Medicaid. And they are going to be hit. And so more people are just going to get sick and die. And this administration doesn't care. It's part of the cruelty part of their agenda.
Mark.
I have a different take.
Okay.
Rather than racing Trump to the bottom, might the Democrats do better if they work to achieve voter repeal by offering a principled and inclusive and effective politics in this country?
Don't blame the Democrats for this.
I'm not blaming them.
Everybody's saying they're not doing anything. They're not blah, blah, blah. What's happening now is the organizing that needs to be done in order to win in 2026.
My point is this. I'm not blaming them for what the Republicans are doing. Let's be clear. Right? There's no Democrat hand in that.
No.
But in terms of a response, should we spend our time, for instance, in California, they would have to have a special session, a special election, overturn existing laws. In New York, we've already seen that you could argue that some of the Hochul's failed attempts at redistricting, the Democrats' failed attempts at redistricting, didn't necessarily benefit them in the last election. If you open that can of worms again, it may or may not work at the margin. Hold on. Wouldn't it be better if the Democrats actually took the Republicans on and offered a better political solution? That's my answer here. Disenfranchising.
That's long term, Mark. And short term, Texas is going to do what they're going to do, and we will lose the House if the Democrats don't do something to counter it.
Yeah, what they should do is run an effective campaign against what should be the most vulnerable administration in our lifetimes. And if the Democrats can't do that, screwing around and maybe gaining 3 seats in California and 2 in New York isn't going to solve it. Spend your time where it matters. That's my view.
And just so I fully understand, spending time where it matters, and where it matters right now, where you can make a difference is where?
Politically, in terms of the message that you convey, the candidates that you select, and the alternative that you propose to the Republicans.
But that's long term. Right. That's the issue here. It's long term versus short term, and we are going to be up against the short term reality that they're going to gerrymander this beyond any reasonable measure for us to be able to take it back.
Whoa. Okay. So
within a generation or two.
But let's talk through this. What's happening in Texas may be unethical. It may disenfranchise voters, but it seems like it's going to end up being quote unquote legal, right?
Because of the way they have crafted their laws with the Republicans being in charge of every house
for
the last 25 years.
Okay, we can argue that we hate it, mm-hmm. but it's probably going to end up being legal, right? So the question is you're sitting in the Democrat National Committee, do you try to change laws in California and redistrict in New York? And by the way, where they're going in Illinois, Pritzker, I mean, he sits in a state that from a bipartisan committee got an F in terms of the redistricting that they last did. So, I mean, the Democrats
both parties
do it. But do you think the Democrats are better off trying to counter it technically with redistricting or just running a much better campaign against what should be the easiest target in our lifetime?
Both.
I think getting caught up in a race to the bottom with Trump and the Republicans is a mistake.
We'll see.
You know, I do think that what's going on in Texas should be a reminder for Americans as to the partisan interests that drive redistricting, how it really works. Mark, you were just mentioning Illinois. We could look at many, many, many other states. There's a handful that have tried to do a nonpartisan approach. I think it's Arizona, Michigan. I'm not sure how many others, or if any others. But including here in the state that we're sitting in New York, it is a very partisan operation. And so if that is the beginning point and it's those partisan interests that determine those lines every 10 years or now perhaps even between the 10 years, that's problematic at a deeper level. Now, Libby, you were saying this, that's a long-term issue to address. It's come up before, it's come up in this state, and you know, people chew on it and try to come up with something, and sometimes it passes muster with the courts and sometimes it doesn't. But if people are unwilling to address that kind of deeper fix, we're going to be in this cycle perpetually about, you know, who's in charge, who gets to draw the lines, who's out of power and who doesn't get to draw the lines. And this is also very toxic for our political system. And I think the chickens are coming home to roost.
I think it's fair to say that Hochul's threat to do this in New York is in part based on her hope that her pick as Chief Justice, right, will allow for a reversal of the disposition that the court took towards redistricting last time and make it easier. I mean, so again, it's part of the race to the bottom. I think running a principled campaign is a much better anecdote here.
I think you got to do both. I'm sorry. You have to act short term and you have to act long term. There's no other way of doing it, because if we only focus on the long term, which I agree with you, we should be doing, okay, everything, the entire field, playing field will change so that the long term strategy you just developed won't even work. And that's the problem.
If there's a party in the United States that can't take a majority in the House in the wake of what Trump has done and will continue to do, that's a problem.
Well, it's a problem, yes, but there's also a lot of other factors involved in all of this. Trump lies. His base believes him. It's about the 30 to 35% of NOPs in this country that are not registered with NOPs or no party people, right? And getting messaging to them that will move them. When they can't feed their kids, when they can't put clothes on their backs, when they are medically bankrupted because they ended up in the hospital and there's no health insurance, you know, people will start to say, oh, maybe this wasn't the best for us. And there are a lot of people who are starting to say that now. And, you know, we need to look at 2026, because if we go beyond, if we don't, they will win the House again. I don't know if we can take the Senate, but the Republicans would win the House again. And we will have two more years of authoritarian rule in D.C. who do not care about the little people. They just care about themselves and their pocketbooks.
All right, we have a lot of letters. Let's get to those, and we'll go do a lightning round for about 5 minutes or so before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour.
Never mind. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Here's what we're going to do.
No, sorry.
Okay, was on something else?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
Something else.
Good. I thought you were voting on what we're going to do. Okay. No. Panel. This is to the panel. Raina says, when they go low, we go high didn't work. Sorry, the only way to beat a bully is to punch back. That is from Raina in Saugerties. Then, the Democrats have already run a clear and inclusive campaign. Kamala Harris laid out her plan to help people while highlighting the destructive things the GOP was planning. There is a concerted effort from the right-wing media outlets to skew the truth. And although there is a cult-like atmosphere, the presidential election was not a landslide for Donald Trump or the GOP. You need stability to plan long-term. We don't have stability now, so we need to deal with it right now. That from Naomi in Beacon. We go to Joanne, the suggestion that the Democrats need to take the high road and not counter Republican gerrymandering in the short term is ludicrous, in my humble opinion. We have no taking the high road on all of the past presidential elections, and yet we have lost to Trump twice. The Democrats must continue to take the high road in the long term, as Libby points out. However, we must now fight fire with fire so we can achieve free and fair elections. And that is from Joanne. Teresa writes, most large blue states have laws or constitutional amendments against political gerrymandering. New York State has such a constitutional amendment. GOP states do not, and so they freely politically gerrymander. Democrats need to aggressively move to redistrict as primarily a way to defuse the Republican efforts. Sad, but that's where we are at this point.
So I just have to disagree with that letter, which is basically saying the Republicans gerrymander, and in the blue states, the Democrats don't. That's just not the reality. Irrespective of what the New York State Constitution might say, the reality of how the lines are drawn in New York State is deeply political, and the process is political. And so they overstepped and made it so political that it went to the courts, and a special master was assigned, and then, you know, it turned into a complete mess. But one should not fool themselves into thinking this is only one party that does this. It's as much as one might want to believe that is not true.
Go to Jackie, who says, I agree with Libby's assessment, and frankly, she's been in the trenches of actual elections and campaigns, and there is simply no time for the 2026 midterms to not try and do what the reps are now doing in Texas. Then we go to Bob, who says maybe instead of campaigning on social issues and instead campaign on economic issues that blue-collar workers are concerned about, maybe Democrats could stand a chance against the Republicans. Democrats abandoned higher minimum wage, universal health care, workers' rights in favor of corporate millionaire, billionaire donations to fund their campaigns. We need to break the duopoly. Then there is this letter from, these letters are very long. Paul, Bernie says, I love the show. And while Libby says no one will understand the inside baseball of economics, I appreciate that much more than Libby's fear-mongering. Even though I may agree with Libby on many subjects, being a lobbyist clouds her objectivity. I agree with Mark. Democrats must offer better options. All right, there we go. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we'll be back for the last half hour of the show right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Mark Whitman, Jim Ketter, and Libby Post make up the group, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We got through a bunch of letters there right before the break, and we'll do that again before the end of the panel, which will be at the top of this hour. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let's go into some other stories, and we have a couple to get to, so we'll try to get as far as we can today. Former Trump prosecutor Jack Smith faces investigation by the Office of the Special Counsel, this according to the Washington Post. And this was announced just, I believe, late Friday. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel said that it is taking the unusual step of investigating Jack Smith, the former Justice Department official, actually this happened Saturday morning, who oversaw two federal prosecutions of Donald Trump for potentially violating the law barring federal officials from political activity. The independent agency tasked with overseeing investigations into partisan influence and coercion confirmed its investigation of Smith over potential Hatch Act violations. The Hatch Act prohibits most federal employees from using their office authority to influence elections or engage in overt political activity on the job. If the office concludes a federal employee has violated the law, it refers the case to the president. Discipline can range from a reprimand to a removal from federal service. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, a Republican, on Wednesday called for an investigation into Smith, asking Acting Special Counsel Jameson Greer, who is also serving as Trump's U.S. Trade Representative and Acting Director of the Office of Government Ethics, and soon to be the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, perhaps, in a letter to look into whether Smith unlawfully took political actions to influence the 2024 election to harm then-candidate President Donald Trump. That from the Washington Post. Here is my very simple question. How would any special counsel be able to do their job in investigating a president without it having perhaps an effect on the election?
I mean, this reading of the Hatch Act just sounds not only a stretch, but absurd.
Yeah.
And the kind of thing that leads us down the road again to behave in the way that we see other countries around the world that have been down this road behaving, where you use the institutions of government and you twist existing law toward political benefit in this kind of way. And so, yeah, Joe, to your question, I mean, if this is a violation of the Hatch Act, then any investigation of anybody at any time could be construed as anybody who's already in office or has been in office would be construed as a violation of the Hatch Act, which not only makes the law meaningless in a way, but just as another step toward weaponizing the institutions. And this is the weaponizing is the very thing that they've been arguing against. And now they're in fact doing it.
Well, they've always done this. They create the problem and then they fix the problem. They create a concept, weaponizing government, and then they use it against their enemies. This is just a way to once again divert people's attention from what's really going on. They can't do anything to Jack Smith. What are they going to do? He doesn't work for the federal government anymore. So he's not under their purview. He's not, you know, he's a private citizen. There's nothing that they can do unless they're really going to, you know, for the lack of a better word, trump up charges and, you know, and take him to court for something that was his job. You know,
I mean, they could go after him if, in fact, they're going to go after him for Hatch Act. But, if they're saying he did it while he was in office.
Yeah. But the thing is, the Hatch Act says you either get reprimanded and then the worst you can do is you get fired. Well, he's not there anymore. So they can't fire him.
I think the teeth in the Hatch Act are more than just that.
Not according to this article. No, no.
Yeah.
And so this is just
I'm trying to think back when I was working in the federal government. We were always lectured.
Yeah, well, you're lectured, not to do anything.
Much more serious.
So were people in the state who were federally funded.
Yeah.
You know, but this is really just another opportunity for Trump to play the victim. That's all this is. They are just making this stuff up so he can look like a victim and that the Democrats are always against me and they weaponize government, so I'm going to do it. It's just it's a non-story story, but it's a story because Trump and his ilk are making it into one. But they can't do anything to Smith. They could try to throw him in jail. They could try to deport him. Let's see if that is what he's going to do, because that's what he's threatening with everyone. But this is like, okay, he was doing his job. And that's part of the problem for Trump. he doesn't want people to do their job like the woman who ran the Bureau of Labor Statistics if it doesn't make him look good. It's just that simple.
Yeah, to me, I'm sorry, who's the guy who called for this on Friday? Cotton.
Yeah,
to me, this is Cotton approaching the throne, kneeling and holding up on a pillow.
Genuflect.
Well, let's have an investigation. I found a way to have an investigation against Jack Smith, and it smacks as an echo of James Comer's attempts to try and impeach Biden during his administration. This isn't going anywhere. It's not serious. It's there for the press.
Yes.
And it's Cotton just proving how subservient he is to the cause.
Yeah.
And this to me, I file under the category of those who have found Bigfoot. I mean, it's just I have no interest in listening to it.
But I think it's serious in the sense that it is another step toward chipping away at our institutions, at key elements of our institutions that are constructed with a specific purpose, constructed out of a historical time that when we required these kinds of investigations to happen and for them to be insulated from political pressures, et cetera. And so, you know, maybe in terms of Smith himself, the consequences aren't that dire, perhaps. But I think for the health of our institutions going forward, I think it is dire when you see it cumulatively.
During Trump's first term, he largely ignored the office even after it found the senior advisor Kellyanne Conway had violated the Hatch Act by making partisan statements and recommended her removal. The Washington Post reports that more than a dozen Trump officials during his first term flouted the law against politicking, and the administration had a willful disregard for the law, according to the watchdog. In May, Trump announced that he had selected Paul Ingrassia, a former right-wing podcast host, to lead the OSC, the Office of Special Counsel. Ingrassia, the current White House liaison for the Department of Homeland Security, has publicly advocated for white supremacist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, writing on X, that dissident voices such as Fuentes should have a place in conservative politics. He was also part of a legal team representing self-described misogynist influencer Andrew Tate, who has been charged with human trafficking, and forming an organized crime group in Romania, as well as rape, actual bodily harm, and human trafficking in Britain. After his election was announced, Ingrassia, who has a history of partisan statements, said in a post on X that he would work to revitalize fairness in the enforcement of the Hatch Act.
Yeah. They don't know what the word means.
Fairness?
Yes, because it's the Trump dictionary that they're not going by Webster's. They're going by the Trump dictionary, which has redefined every single piece of moral ethics in our country. And so fairness is not fairness for them. Fairness is making sure that Trump doesn't get dinged in any way and that they maintain their power. I mean, this is the sycophant party is all getting on their knees and genuflecting to Trump so that they can maintain whatever scrap of power they think they have.
I actually, Joe, can I? You read the piece from the Washington Post.
I did.
That got me a little hot under the collar, but.
Ooh, yeah. I didn't mean to do that.
It was not you reading it when I read
no,
it.
No, I mean that I sent it over to you, yes.
But the Washington Post does this a lot. We talked about this on Friday when they said that there was backlash to Israel for what the Netanyahu government is doing, and they conflated the two. To say that this guy Fuentes is a bad dude because he won't disavow anti-Semites is legitimate. To say he's a bad dude because he represented somebody as a lawyer on their defense team, that's something that we not only permit but encourage in this country. So the Washington Post, to me, look, I still have my subscription. You can write in and hate me for it. But the Post continually sort of conflates things that it shouldn't.
Okay, Nick Fuentes is not a lawyer. In what they're talking about, that he also was also part of a legal team representing Andrew Tate. It was Ingrassia that they're talking
about. Ingrassia, thank you. I'm sorry.
Not
Fuentes. No. But they're criticizing Ingrassia for not disavowing Fuentes, which is legitimate. Ding, check
he's
mark.
He's a white supremacist and an anti-Semite.
Right. That, if you can't disavow Nick Fuentes, right, then to me, you shouldn't be anywhere near our federal government. Mm-hmm. But when you say he worked on the defense team of, I put my fingers in my ears. I don't even care who it is. I'm okay with people being public defenders and defending the worst of the worst. That's how the system works. And I think it's reprehensible that the Washington Post proposes that that's another reason that I should hate someone. And I think you don't have to think long and hard about even Supreme Court justices that were recently appointed to decide why that's a bad standard.
I don't think that the Post wrote this to say you should hate Ingrassia. I think they wrote the facts. And people are getting upset with the Post and the Times and journalism in general of reporting the facts. The fact is, Ingrassia was part of the legal team representing the self-described misogynist influence Andrew Tate, who's been charged with human trafficking and forming an organized crime group in Romania, as well as rape, actual bodily harm, and human trafficking in Britain. So all they're saying is, oh, by the way, he also represented this guy.
Well, they're trying to point out the hypocrisy, right?
Yeah, I mean, but they're listing it behind the Fuentes thing on purpose. They're trying to impugn his suitability for the position. If you accidentally list a bunch of facts, I think a fair reading of that article tells you that they're suggesting that's another reason why he's not qualified to be in the position. Now, you had me at hello when you said that he's an apologist for Fuentes. But mm-hmm. when you keep going and you degrade the act of being a defense attorney for anyone, I have a problem with that, and I have a problem with what the Post did.
But it also, and to your point too, it gets away from the issue, which is that of looking in, having an investigation against Jack Smith and Jameson Greer, and who is also serving as Trump's U.S. Trade Representative, taking a look at this and then moving this forward. After Tom Cotton got, I mean, like, as you said, you had at hello, like, that's the story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the other stuff is just is
it's just reporting. Sorry.
No, it is. Okay.
It's just reporting.
I understand your view. I respectfully disagree.
OK.
I don't think it's an accident. It's there. And I don't think it should be there.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll have another story or two before the end of our program. We welcome you. Last call for letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 4th of August. It is 10 minutes before 11 o'clock. We have about 7 or 8 minutes with our group left, and let's go to what will probably be our final story. Also, last call on the letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. This is an issue that we've been bringing up over the last several weeks. And that is, we have obviously told you, and you are aware, and we talked about it again on Friday morning, about the cuts to public radio and public television, public broadcasting as a whole. And that comes through the stripping of public money through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It has now been announced that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting will close following Congress's decision to strip its current funding and foreclosure on future appropriations. The CPB, established by the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, we're the same age, is a nonprofit set up to dole out congressionally appropriated funds to NPR, PBS, and public radio and TV stations around the United States. President Donald Trump launched a successful campaign to claw back the $1.1 billion allocated for the organization for the next 2 years, a measure he signed into law last month. At the heart of the campaign was a critique that public media produced news that is biased and too liberal and should not be funded by taxpayer dollars. That argument long held among many conservatives finally prevailed thanks to unified Republican government during Trump's second term. Despite the extraordinary efforts of millions of Americans who called, wrote, and petitioned Congress to preserve federal funding for CPB, we now face the difficult reality of closing our operations, according to CPB President and CEO Patricia Harrison. The CPB remains committed to fulfilling its fiduciary responsibilities and supporting our partners through this transition with transparency and care. CPB not only served as a funding middleman between Congress and public media stations, but also negotiated music rights and procured technical infrastructure on behalf of the station. That leaves an open question as to what entity, if any, will fill that gap. The closure was announced one day after the Senate Appropriations Committee released the bill that would zero out funding for the CPB. In a press release, the CPB said it told its employees that most positions would be cut on September 30th, the final day of the fiscal year, and a small team will stay on to shut down the agency through January. And that is, again, would be cut on September 30th. That from the Washington Post. Jim.
You know, I just think about this in the context of many other institutions that have already been either completely shut down in the few months that the Trump administration has been in power, or have had major components of them carved out. And, you know, I'm thinking about what Mark was saying in terms of the Democrats running campaigns that are more principled. And, you know, I would think that not only on specific policies, but what would be the Democrats' vision that they would propose in such a case? But what is the Republican vision? What is the end game here with the closing down of these institutions, the removing of personnel, and all else that's going on? What is the overall vision that is being proposed? I could, on my own, fill in the gaps, and it's a pretty dark vision, I think. But I don't think I've really heard it fully articulated, not just by the president, but by the supporters, and particularly by members of Congress who have also ceded a lot of their power in this process. You know, things like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or USAID or on and on and on. These are institutions that were created in largely in the 1960s and have had bipartisan support for many decades. So what is the new vision that replaces that old vision that created these institutions in the 60s and 70s predominantly?
State-controlled media like TASS in Russia. We have to remember Hitler didn't start with the camps. He started with banning books, targeting the press, blaming immigrants, all of this stuff, creating enemies from neighbors, you know, defunding the arts. I mean, you know, this is the Hitlerian playbook that we're seeing play out now in the United States, and we have to stop it. But they don't want a free press. I mean, clearly, the allowing Skydance to buy CBS, Paramount, it's part of the ongoing monopoly capital of journalism. I read a book called Monopoly Journalism when I was in school. And it was about how all these little papers, how the TV stations are all being taken over by corporate America. And this was, well, I graduated in 84, so this was a long time ago, right? And we're seeing it all play out now and how it impacts media coverage of this administration and everybody else. Now, there are some very independent people who stand up for the media and work every day to report the news. And, you know, I have a job to do, they have a job to do, but I respect what they're doing because it's a tenet of our country is a free press. It's in the Constitution. So what we're having here is both from a corporate and political perspective, where we're getting rid of that amendment. It'll still be on the books, but nobody's really paying attention to it.
Mark, 2 minutes.
I actually, the Skydance Paramount merger, I don't think this economy lacks for media alternatives. So I don't worry about that. I also think it's okay if a group that's come together to make a profit decides that cooperating with the government and protecting that profit is in their shareholders' best interest. I think that's fine. I don't think it's fine when Columbia, Brown, or Harvard capitulate to the government. They have very different mission statements, and we've talked about that, and should have a very different perspective.
But it's the same thing. It's the same capitulation.
I think it's very different. I think when your mission is to enhance the wealth of shareholders, it's one mission. I think when your mission is to enhance the dissemination of truthful information, you have a very different obligation. And I think universities are falling down. I think law firms have a different obligation than just profit. And they've fallen down on that score. And what this underscores for me, and we can agree on this part of it, Libby, is I am so grateful that this and many other public radio stations are well supported and will remain despite the dissolution of the CPB. But that's the headline for me.
But the thing about journalism is it's not about protecting the shareholders. It's never been about protecting shareholders. It's always been about telling the truth and giving information to people so that they can make up their own minds. Reporting on scandal. Reporting. Look, the media brought down, the Washington Post brought down Richard Nixon, right? All the President's Men, one of my favorite movies, right? When you have corporate monopolies controlling the media, the ethos of journalism gets worn away day after day after day, capitulating to an administration that doesn't want a free press.
We have to go. So I'll just say WAMC.org if you want to help out. Jim, Mark, Libby, you're the best. Thanks.